Okay, we are starting tonight then with the book of Esther, remembering that we're still in the midst of history that is covered by the book of Ezra. So really, we're doing the history, we're doing Ezra. That led us, though, into a discussion of Haggai and Zechariah in a survey manner. So we were just doing an overview on those two books. Zechariah being a particularly thorny book, his prophecies are so many years later, and for us then, unfamiliar with their culture and times, somewhat obscure on occasions. And now coming off Haggai and Zechariah, who were the two prophets sent by God to motivate these people in the first six chapters of the book of Ezra to finish, to complete the second temple, what is called the second temple. Solomon built his temple, stood for over 400 years. It's torn down in 586 B.C. by Nebuchadnezzar. The Jews go into captivity in three waves, first in 606, 597, again in 586, when the temple's destroyed. And they will be spending 70 years in that Babylonian captivity till the Medo-Persians defeat Babylon. Then, as is the custom of the Medes, very much as opposed to the Babylonians, they allow anybody, not just the Jews, but anybody who had been previously captured and dispossessed, to be able to go back to their homelands. That was their national policy. So the Jews as well are allowed to return. They will also return in three different waves. And so we'll be talking about the book of Esther now. But these last chapters, 7 through 10 of Ezra, will be dealing with a different return than the one we read about in the first part of Ezra. So I realize we're getting some weeks away from Ezra here, but we are also passing down through some time because there's a big time gap here, as you can see on the timeline layout, in these last chapters of Ezra, 7 through 10, as opposed to the first six. So tonight, since the book of Esther falls in the middle of this time gap right here, we're going to try to do a survey of all 10 chapters. So we'll be working with the book of Esther, much like Charlton Heston did in the chariot races. Ben-Hur. It'll go fast, but I think it will be fine. It is essentially a single story. It is a very straightforward historical record. There are no prophecies. It isn't like Zechariah or Haggai. It is just simply a moment in time that has resulted in a long-term festival for the Jews that they're still practicing to this day. And so the book of Esther has a couple of lessons that are tremendously enjoyable and encouraging, but we all know the story as well. And so I'm choosing, particularly with Esther here tonight, to do a very light treatment. I'm going to cover the entire book here this evening, noting, first of all, that the date and the author are quite completely unknown. We know the general time frame. We know, you know, when these events were taking place with some certainty. But when was the book written and who was the author of the book is really not possible to tell. Mordecai, who is, of course, directly related to Esther and main player in the book of Esther. Mordecai is a good possibility. He may well have been the one that wrote the book. But, you know, we cannot say that for sure. We can say, though, one author put it this way, and this is a quote, among the Jews, Esther is the best known of all the books of the Bible, end quote. And so among those throughout the centuries, actually, and then even now, after God has removed them, you know, as God's chosen people, there is no more Jew-Gentile distinction, and the Jews have no special place in God's plans for the last 2,000 years. Still, this is a particularly precious book for those who would style themselves as Jews today. And so it is beloved, whether you're a Jew or a Christian. It's just a marvelous book. But we're really very familiar with it, so very fast here this evening. With that, what I'm going to do is just give you the verses that I'll be reading at the top of each of these slides. So you'll be able to follow along with me. We'll have a separate slide for each chapter. So each time, you know, we change, and you'll know, and then we're going to the next chapter. But the reference is there as well. And we can pick up the thread with great clarity and leaning on your familiarity, probably be able to get through this, which is no problem here this evening. So we're going to start with the first four verses. It's the book opens up in this manner. It took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence, and he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, for 180 days. So if you want to grab your pencil, it is probably very important and helpful for you to know that while the Bible is referring to him as Ahasuerus, like so many of the ancient kings who are rather fond of taking new names when they become kings that will reflect some aspect, you know, of their self-imposed glory and all that, he is better known among historians today as Xerxes. It's the same man. So Ahasuerus and Xerxes are one and the same. And you might put that in, you know, some kind of parenthesis or something there at the start of the book. And then it would be interesting to note as well that in verse 3, the third year of his reign is when this takes place. And that would be always a little bit of, you know, slide rule, you know, one side or the other, but 483 B.C., so these events are about 483 B.C. And in 483 B.C., nobody knows why Vashti did what she did. But as you turn now to verses 10 through 12, on the seventh day of this feast, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahaman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zephar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, his wrath burned within him, and the speculations have been endless. What did he ask her to do? We don't know. And so please don't, you know, embrace or accept any idea you've ever heard about her motivation. From her astonishing virtue in the face of these times and places and everything, which is one end of the spectrum, you know, to she's just a wretched old woman, self-serving, and didn't want to be obedient and deserved everything she got. I don't know. It could be any mixture of all of the above or none of the above. We don't know. So, useless to try to speculate. In verses 16 through 21, though, her whole world is going to cave in because of this decision. So, whether or not she's doing something admirable or just being really foolish, I don't know. The king wanted to show off her beauty. That's not all that an unusual thing in and of itself, necessarily, but she refused for whatever reason, and this is what happens in 16 through 21. In the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. This day, the ladies of Persian Media, who've heard of the queen's conduct, will speak to all the king's princes. There'll be plenty of contempt and anger. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him. Let it be written in the laws of Persian Media so that it cannot be repealed. Vashti should come no more in the presence of King Ahasuerus. Let the king give her royal position to another who's more worthy than she. When the king's edict, which he shall make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. This word pleased the king and the princes. The king did as Memucan proposed, so he sent letters to all the king's provinces. Let it be so. And thus ends our first chapter. Well, Vashti did something disobedient as a matter of fact. And it may well be so back then as it is now. Well, if we let that woman drive in Arabia, then what next? They'll all be dry. So, you know, every potentate has his rules and every culture has its ways, and we don't know a whole lot about the circumstances. But Vashti, whether she just foresaw it, knew it was coming, or was very surprised, or whatever it was, she's out the door. And the king's looking for a new queen. So as we come to chapter 2, verses 3 through 11, let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to Susa the capital, to the harem, into the custody of Hegai the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. The matter pleased the king. He did accordingly. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital. It's the third time we've heard about Susa. Daniel mentioned Susa, saw a vision that involved Susa, one of the three capitals of the Medo-Persians. So he's there, and his name is Mordecai. He's the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about when the commander and decree, when the command and decree of the king were heard, many young ladies were gathered to Susa the capital into the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the woman. Now the young lady pleased him, found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. And every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she feared. Grab your pencil again, because we love these dates. You know, they're interesting and helpful, of course, in any form of academic study, but certainly in our Bible studies here. And next to verse 6, 5. Mordecai is a Jew. He's in the capital city, but he's the son of 3 guys. So his dad, Jair, his grandfather, Shimei, and his great-grandfather, Kish, are all mentioned. That then, in those 3 generations, gives us enough information as we see that this Kish was taken captive, that of the 3 assaults that Nebuchadnezzar made upon Israel, it's the middle one in 597 when the Benjamite Kish was taken into captivity. He was taken then into captivity at the same time that Ezekiel was taken into captivity. So a lot of very important people that have the biblical, you know, ties were captured in 597. And now he's the 4th generation. So we have, you know, a coincidence and corroboration for the dates of the time that this is taking place. And you want to mention this invasion then would be the one in verses 5 and 6 of 597. So, Esther wins the beauty pageant. The whole kingdom's just looking for the most beautiful women they could find. And Esther is supplied with all of, you know, the means that women know to make themselves as presentable and beautiful as possible. And she wins. But she's also hiding her ancestry. So Mordecai and apparently Esther and his advice, both of them are wanting to stay under the radar, which as queen of Medo-Persia is going to be a tough thing to do. But nonetheless, he's counseling, you know, it'd be better, it'd be safer, it'd be wiser, you just don't say anything about your being a Jew. But by the time we come to the end of this chapter, verses 21 through 23, we have this wondrous good fortune for Mordecai. that in those days, while he's sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Endless court intrigues of anybody, you know, and easy is the head under the crown. But the plot in 22 became known to Mordecai. He told Queen Esther. Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. When the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. Please note here that when Mordecai and then Esther play this role in saving the king, he writes it down in the book of Chronicles. Is that our book of Chronicles? No. Chronicles are Chronicles. Every king's got them. This is not 1st and 2nd Chronicles in your Bible. You're not going to find this record over in those books. They're written in the Chronicles of the kings of Medo-Persia. Scant evidence of which we have to this day, and no evidence therein do we have of Mordecai. So we don't have any of the uninspired records that were written so many years ago, 2,500 years ago, are in the Chronicles of Medo-Persia about Mordecai, but certainly they were so. Now, for the first time tonight, you know, let me just mention that the book of Esther has an unhappy place in canonicity studies as being one of the most hotly contested books in all the Bible. Does it belong in the canon? That is, the authorized, inspired books of God that we call the Bible, does Esther belong there? And one of the arguments you'll have is, well, there's no corroboration anywhere else. Well, that would be true of a lot of Bible books, though. But it is just another thing that people will throw at Esther. You will find saints in the Lord's church who do not believe that Esther deserves a place in the Bible. That argument, you know, to me is pretty weak, this particular one. In my personal opinion, I think all the arguments against the book, you know, are weak. But you just should know, unconvincing, I would say, maybe not, you know, I don't want to accuse you guys of having weak arguments, but, you know, they're unconvincing anyway. I'm sure it's a Bible book. I have every confidence that it is. The lessons that it teaches, you know, are universal, and it also, you know, thoroughly explains a traditional feast day that we have among those who call themselves Jews, even to this day. But, you know, as the second chapter ends, Mordecai and Esther are becoming extremely influential people in the kingdom. And so they're going to now have quite an adventure that involves their whole people in an attempted genocide. This will begin in chapter 3 for another mysterious reason. In chapter 3, in the first four verses, after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. Now, this is not, how do I say this? This is not a real strong kind of a, you know, conviction that I can offer you now. But I will say there's at least a possibility, not thoroughly confirmed, you know, yet, but Agagite may have been their Medo-Persian way of referring to the Amalekites. Now, if that's so, you want to make a note with a question mark, Agagite equals Amalekite. You know, it could, it maybe does, there's enough similarity, there's some reason to think, you know, possibly, it's not real strong, but could be. Now, if he has long genealogies as a very powerful man of Medo-Persia going back to the Amalekites, how might he feel about the Jews? He would have reason in family lore and records to not think very well of them, because the Amalekites and the Jews have always been, in your Bible, what? Terrible enemies. Had all kinds of problems, you know, book after book. And so maybe that's the case and would help to explain some of the most unreasonable wrath that we're going to see in this man later. But it's not for sure. See, I don't know, so we just make the note. Could be that an Agagite is an Amalekite of long ago. But it turns out that all the king's servants in verse 2 who were at the king's gate bowed down, paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command?" Now it was when they had spoken daily to him and he would not listen to them that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. "What is Mordecai's reason that I will not pay homage to you, Haman? I'm a Jew." Now once again, brethren, let the speculations begin. We're not told what was going on in Mordecai's mind. We're not told the form of honor that was insisted upon. But somehow, it was violating Mordecai's sensibilities as a Jew. He felt that, apparently, he would have had bigger problems with God if he did what Haman was asking than he would have with Haman for agreeing to do it. He's just, or for refusing, rather. And so he's got a terrible moral dilemma. And we have profile in courage, number one. Okay, here's Mordecai. And what is he doing with regard to his conscience? "I don't care who you are. I don't care how high you are in all the Medo-Persian superpower empire and the king's edict itself. You've asked me to do what my conscience will not allow me to do. I'm not going to do it." And so he doesn't. But the particulars are completely missing. In verse 7, "In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur," that is the lot, "was cast before Haman." That means the guys who, you know, are the soothsayers and supposedly have the power and can read, you know, what they throw down, the stones or the dice or whatever it is they're using. They come in front of Haman at his request for his reasons to find out what he wants to know. They come before him and they cast Pur day to day, month to month, until the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Now don't get the wrong idea. It does not mean that every day they came to Haman for a year, and then they throw the chicken bones, is one of the ways they used to do this, to see how they lay it, and that would tell you, you know, if you knew how to read them, you know, what to do. It wasn't that at all. What it is, it came on one occasion. And first, Haman wants to know, what is it, I have a hard time finding this now, would I say verse 7? Day to day, month to month, until the 12th month. Okay. He's casting day to day. So probably, 30 days in a month, they probably had to throw until these soothsayers said, "Oh, whatever it is they're doing, it's the 12th. Oh, well, it'll be 14 days. Okay? And so that's the day that the casting of the lots has picked. Okay, well, what month is it? Cast for the first month, cast for the second month, and then what does it come to? Adar, Adar. Okay, so they had one occasion, but many castings, until they were able to determine, you know, with their magical powers, what this chosen day was going to be, so important to this man Haman. What's the day? Well, in verse 13, "Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder." So when the third chapter concludes, Haman is so mad at Mordecai because he won't pay him the respect he thinks he deserves, that he wants to take it out on every living, breathing Jew that there is. Somehow Haman has found out that Mordecai is a Jew. We've already been told, what's Mordecai been doing? He's been laying low until he gets caught and then ask him repeatedly, "Why won't you do this?" So finally, what does he step up and say?
I am a Jew. Now they know. And now, perhaps, Haman is even angrier than just the fact that he won't, you know, revere the guy. Maybe he's got ancestral animosities that endure in the midst of all this too. We're not sure. But he goes to genocide as his solution, if he can but make it happen. So in chapter 4 is the heart of the book. It's the soul of the book. It's really the whole message of the entire book. This story is very elaborately portrayed. So we enjoy the book, we like the book, but the message is really very small. The kernel is right here in these verses. So we learn about cosmetics in chapter 1. We learn about all kinds of things around the edges so that it becomes almost a movie as it's portrayed. But we're skipping the details. And we're going to look now, though, at what is the reason, I believe, the book was ever written in the first place and then added to the canon where it belongs. In chapter 4, verses 5 through 17. Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why. This edict has gone forth to kill all the Jews. 6. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square from the king's gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Now, it was an immense sum. I skipped over it as one of the details. But when he approached the king to get all these Jews killed because Mordecai won't honor me, he offered the king a fortune, apparently to defray the costs of genocide, and also showing how much he really wanted this to be done. So this is all explained now in verse 7 to Esther. He also gave him, the go-between, a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and order her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. So, was this whole book of Esther, with which we're all so fond and familiar, Esther's idea? Esther is just caught up in the river. She isn't making up to this point any choices. She's just been swept up in the events of her day. Mordecai now is putting her under orders. I'm saying you need to do this. You are in a position of power. We're all going to be snuffed out here come 12 months. You got to do something about it. So in verse 9, Hathach came back, related Mordecai's words to Esther. Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. Quote, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law. He be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king these 30 days. She hasn't even seen the king in 30 days. Now again, let the speculations begin. I have no idea why that's the case. Maybe she was on vacation, or maybe he was out of town. I don't know. But what the deal is, now she knows it's been 30 days. They related Esther's words to Mordecai. Mordecai told in reply to Esther, verse 13, do not imagine that you, in the king's palace, can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. Now most of us, because these words are so beloved and so rightly so, can nearly quote them. You've seen them innumerable times in the course of your lives. Was it Esther's idea? No, she has to be told to get over her objection. She says, "What? I haven't been called for 30 days. You're going to get me killed." Mordecai's response is, "That's right. One way or the other, you're going to die unless you step up your game here and step up to the plate, summon your courage, and get in there to that king." So she agrees. Under Mordecai's pressure, she agrees. Go. 16. Assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa, fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. Now, purely, only, and exclusively, for the sake of clarity so far, I've kept saying, was any of this Esther's idea? No. Should that take away one iota from the magnificent courage that she shows here? She says, "Okay, I'm out of argument. Oh, I see my duty, and I accept it." And from her amazing wisdom, she says, "Okay, only one thing I ask, what is it?" Want everybody fast for 3 days. Now, by the way, I think this is really helpful, totally unrelated, you know, directly to all of this, but I think it's really, really helpful. Look at verse, verse 16. It says, "Fast for me." Okay? Fast. But then notice the clarification. Do not eat or drink for 3 days. Now, brother, I would suggest, and I think certainly so, that what that indicates is if you say, "Fast for me," that would include somebody saying, "I won't drink anything for a certain period of time, but I am going to eat." Or conversely, they could say, "Well, I'm not going to eat, but I am going to drink." She has to clarify when she says fast that she means both. That suggests that the term is broad enough to have a number of different applications. What did she then add to that? Well, 3 days, yes, but then what's at the end? Yes, Carol's got it, night or day. So that would suggest then what? You could fast during the day, but not at night, you know, if you chose. Okay? So, and I think that is the Bible's teaching uniformly, but now we're seeing it here among the Jews in the captivity. This is how they understood it. So, fasting is something you do in dire circumstances. It is something that you decide how you're going to fast in advance. And then the manner that you've decided upon can take a number of different forms. Now, for instance, the last two times that I was in Israel, it was Ramadan. What's Ramadan? It's a 30-day feast for whom? For Muslims. It's a part of Islam. The Jews, it's a part of Islam. They have to fast every single day. How do they fast?
During the day.
During the day. From sunrise to sundown, they don't eat. And then what happens as soon as that sun dips below the horizon? McDonald's makes a fortune. Okay, so everybody eats. It was very interesting. I've grown rather close. I was with him now 3 different times with a Palestinian who lives inside the old city walls. He told me where his house was. And I've had coffee with the man, and I hate coffee, but he asked me, so I go and follow the customs in Bethlehem, as a matter of fact. And so since I've known him, you know, for about 9 or 10 weeks of driving around on buses and all this, you know, I would often, when I have an occasion, I'd go off to the side and I'd talk with him, some places I'd already been, you know, and so I would just go talk to Fauzi, was his name, wonderful guy, I really liked him. But the last 2 times it was Ramadan. And so in 2017, I had been with a tour group, and then when that group all went home, I went back to Jerusalem, spent a week living in Jerusalem, just down the road, you know, not a quarter mile probably from where Fauzi lived. But the deal was, we were on a bus with 40 other people, we took them to the airport, they all went home. James, you went home. Okay? And then I rode the bus with Fauzi. But it was during Ramadan. And so Fauzi had his lunch. And as soon as, you know, sunset came, we dropped everybody off the airport. We're starting home, you know. He breaks out all this stuff. And now I got to eat a bunch of Palestinian stuff. He gave me some figs and all his wife has prepared for him and all that. So just an illustration, though. In our fasting, which you do regularly, right? Probably not regularly, because I've just said, what is fasting? It is for extreme circumstances. And so it's not a thing you do a whole lot, but it ought to be a thing you do. It's taken for granted in the New Testament. But you get to choose how you're going to fast, to what extent, how long, overall, and how much in a day. So I think that's really important and helpful in this book. You know, fasting is taken for granted. Christians will do it in the New Testament. Here you get some help in understanding how. Okay, now then, if I perish, I perish. So she summons her courage. She goes in to represent all of her people. She risks her whole life at this moment. And she will succeed, as we know so well. And so, most famous and best beloved, you know, among those who call themselves Jews today, you know, and justifiably so, this woman plays, you know, a role in preventing genocide among the Jews. Now, let's look at chapter 5, verses 9 through 14. Haman, I'm skipping over the first meal. She's setting things up, and I'm skipping over the first one. But Haman went out that day glad, pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, he did not stand up or tremble before him. Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house, sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches, the number of his sons, every instance where the king had magnified him, how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. Tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Zeresh's wife and all his friends said to him, have a gallows 75 feet high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it, and then go joyfully with the king to the banquet. The advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows built. Okay? Now, here's a lesson for you, you know, out of Esther. When you're harboring hatred, what happens if you would ordinarily be the happiest guy on the planet? Never forget that. His hatred for one guy's disrespect is ruining for him all the other joy. I think maybe there's a lesson in there just to see that hatred is so powerful and so valuable and so influential in your life that you have to be mighty careful with it. In fact, what are we told in the New Testament about anger? Don't let the sun go down on it. Okay? Now, it's hard. You know, a lot of people can do a lot of things that really upset you. Now, I, for one, freely admit, it's often really difficult for me to get over things people do. But Haman, I think, really is a great case in point. You're likely the one who's hurting the most. This brings us to chapter 6, verses 10 through 12. Now, the whole chapter, we only need really these three verses because you know the story. So in 10, the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horses you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you've said. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai, led him on horseback through the city square, proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. And then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning and with his head covered. So we know what happened. King was reading in the Chronicles, found out Mordecai, you know, had saved the king's life a long time ago, and so, you know, what did we do to honor him? Well, nothing. We ought to do something. Haman, what do you think we ought to do for a guy who needs to be honored? What did Haman think? Woo, he's going to honor me. So he creates this whole elaborate thing. The next thing he knows, he's being asked to do it for the mortal enemy who's destroyed all of his happiness and for whom he built a 75-foot tall gallows, and he's proclaiming the glory of the guy all over town. What an amazing moment in time. No wonder we love Esther. You know, things turn around. You reap what you sow. Get your comeuppance too. So, there he is, really having a hard night that night, but chapter 7 is going to be even worse. So in chapter 7, in the first 6 verses, after all this horror has befallen him, King and Haman came to eat and drink with Esther the queen the what time? Second time. Now, brethren, drive me nuts and every other commentator. Why did she do that? Why did she just say it was on her mind the first time? Say it in chorus. I don't know. And we never are. So I don't know what she was up to. But the next day, second time. Verse 2. King said to Esther on the second day also, as they drank their wine at the banquet, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even half the kingdom. It shall be done." Queen Esther answered and said, "If I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we'd only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent. For the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king." She's really a good diplomat here, too. King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he? Who would presume to do thus?" And Esther said, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman became terrified before the king and the queen. And you can only imagine how terrified. Talk about reversals. You know, in 24 hours or less, he's been leading Mordecai through town, and now he's sitting there with the king and just the queen and him, and his whole world caves in. Well, you reap what you sow. He was sure enough asking for it. Now, at this point, I would like to say, earlier we read Mordecai say, "Esther, if you don't step up, somebody else will." How could he know that? He couldn't, I guess, directly. I don't think he was inspired. But he could know enough about Jewish history that if we kill all these Jews, then what?
No Messiah.
We may have a problem even getting a Messiah. This is going to be a major problem. We kill all the Jews that this guy controls. You're killing off most all of them on the whole surface of the planet. So, Mordecai has been positioned by God, as has Esther by God, to be a counterbalance for this guy Haman. God's plans will out. And at this point, we should be giving Mordecai a lot of credit. I'm not taking anything away from Esther. You know I'm not. But Mordecai's faith was also amazing. And the confidence that they were going to survive this night somehow. But the only way he could see it happening was if he could get Esther to step up, which she did. Bob.
I was just going to suggest that was an example of Mordecai's faith.
Exactly that. That's exactly it. He is set forth as an example of faith. He had every confidence. Okay, so let's read 9 and 10 as we hurry on. You can see I just have to rush. I'm sorry. Yeah.
He also makes a statement there in chapter 4 and talking to Esther, and he says, "Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" And I can never read that without applying it to myself. All the different situations that we get in and experience through life, who knows that maybe we're the ones that would make the difference if we step up and do what's right.
Well, absolutely, in the very definition of faith. Faith is when you have a conviction based solidly on all the evidence that is before you to believe in a thing that you can't see or know yet. That's faith. So whenever circumstances befall you, we immediately pass judgment on them. This is wrong. I want this fixed and changed. As often as not, when you read in your Old Testament, you find out those things that we would like to fix and change are the very things we need so that God can work His plans in anybody from Esther and Mordecai down to us this day, as Bob was wisely pointing out. So, step up. And in 9 and 10 of chapter 7, Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided." Now, by the way, it didn't take me too long to find this, but a little bit of research, you know, the proper search terms. That lighthouse in New York is exactly 75 feet tall, right there at the top of the left. And so he would have built a structure, something this tall, and maybe even like this. One has to wonder if in Haman's mind, with apparently vast financial resources at his disposal, this wouldn't be something of a memorial, you know, to his own greatness and a warning to his enemies. And so I'm not so sure, you know, that 75 feet high, it's just some spindly little bit of wood that was going to immediately be torn back down again. May have been every bit as grand as that lighthouse was, for all we know. He sure was trying to make a point. But at any rate, his point has been made. There he is for all the world to see. Now, chapter 8, verses 7 and 8. So King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him that hanged on the gallows, because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked." We've all heard about the law of the Medes and Persians. Cannot be revoked. So 11 and 12. "In them the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and defend their lives, to destroy, kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil on one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month." That's the month of Adar that Haman's soothsayers had picked by casting their lots, which they called Pur, P-U-R. So the Jews are officially given the right to fight back. And in chapter 9, do they ever? In chapter 9, verse 12 through 16, the king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in Susa, the capital," just the one city. "What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your petition? It shall even be granted you. And what is your further request? It shall also be done." Then said Esther, "If it pleases the king, let tomorrow also be granted to the Jews who are in Susa to do according to the edict of today. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows." So the king commanded that it should be done so. And an edict was issued in Susa. And Haman's 10 sons were hanged on that lighthouse, I guess. The Jews who were in Susa assembled also on the 14th day of the month Adar and killed 300 men in Susa, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews were in the king's provinces assembled to defend their lives and rid themselves of their enemies and kill 75,000 of those who hated them, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. 20 through 22. Then Mordecai recorded these events. He sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to celebrate the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same month annually. Because on those days, the Jews rid themselves of their enemies. It was a month which was turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and rejoicing and send portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Verse 26 and 27. Therefore they called these days Purim, after the name of Pur. And because of the instructions in this letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what had happened to them, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and for their descendants and for all those who allied themselves with them, so that they should not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation, according to their appointed time, annually. So what happens? 75,800 and the 10 sons of Haman all die in the Persian Empire because they had obeyed Haman's edict that he had foisted on the king to kill all of the Jews in all of the provinces, 127 of them throughout the entirety of Medo-Persian rule, which includes all of Israel. 75,810 apparently took up arms and thought it was a good idea. And they paid for it with their lives. Yes?
I don't think that it was just Haman's hatred, because the hatred was there with all of these other people too. I mean, when he had been put on the gallows and the edict was there, they could have said, well, we're just not going to do what he wanted us to do. They still hated like he did.
Yeah, Carol's made a great point. Yeah, I've been emphasizing Haman. But he's not the only guy who dislikes Jews in the Persian Empire or any empire before then or since. And so yeah, you're quite right. These others, were just as eager as Haman was, apparently, to put an end to it. So, but there's a lot of history, brethren, and that history is known to all the surrounding nations. When the Jews are behaving and serving God the way they should, is there any nation that could stand before him in the Old Testament? That was God's promise that no nation could stand before him. And so there were plenty of times when the Jews were doing what God wanted them to do, and these nations tried to take them on, and they paid for it every single time. So when I suggest that Haman, if Agagite means Amalekite, might have some history and bad blood, through all those centuries, as Carol's pointing out, well, that could be true everywhere in the entire empire, just as well. Okay, so there's also the question here, we are told in all this that Mordecai writes this down. So this is our indication that Mordecai may have written the book. But it is, as we've just seen then, the establishment of the Feast of Purim, which is practiced by the Jews to this day. So, if there were a living prophet, which there's not, but if there was, and the Jews said, Esther doesn't really tell us how to celebrate this feast. Let's go to the prophet and ask him, oh God, how do you want us to celebrate this feast? What would Zechariah's answer be? When you did this, did you do this for me? Did you fast properly? when we were dealing with Zechariah. Okay, well, no. So in those chapters 7 and 8 of Zechariah, they had these four feasts they invented when Jerusalem fell. Now, it is a sad occasion. They invented the feast, but God didn't. So there, they couldn't appeal to God. God's not going to answer a feast you made up. It doesn't make the feast necessarily evil. It just makes it theirs instead of God's. In like manner, the Jews are celebrating Purim to this day. And this book tells us all about it. But is there any prophet here that says they should do this? Is there? No. Is the name God anywhere in the book? No. It's the only Bible book that doesn't have it. It is, for those that dislike the book then, the strongest evidence they think it shouldn't be in the Bible at all. Now, in this case, I would suggest, it looks to me like God probably was agreeable with this. Certainly Mordecai knew what he was talking about. He did the right thing. Genocide is avoided, all of that. But we're never told the name of God, the word of God, a prophet of God. None of those things are in this book. It is a straightforward historical record of an event that surely took place exactly as described. But the Feast of Purim can only be found where? Not in Moses' law, only here. Which they practice to this day. Then, I don't even need to read it, There's only three verses in chapter 10. You have a little epilogue, who knows why they would have separated it, you know, by a chapter heading. But verse 3, Mordecai becomes second only to King Ahasuerus. Is that starting to sound familiar?
Yep.
It really is. Moses, okay, Joseph,
Daniel.
We've seen it three times already, haven't we? It's number four. Okay? Don't mess with God's people. So what do you want to be? God's people. Have a good night.